From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the 1970s, Lenny Kaye helped make rock history as the guitarist of the groundbreaking Patti Smith Group. Now Kaye is reinterpreting rock history as producer of a new anthology in which contemporary performers do their versions of rock and folk songs of the past 40 years. In this edition of Fresh Air, we look back with Lenny Kaye. Also today, we meet actor Michael Rooker. He had the lead role in one of the most disturbing movies of recent years, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Actor and writer John O'Keefe performs an excerpt of his latest work, and film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the first movie to be rated NC-17, Henry in June. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House Budget Director Richard Darman told government agency chiefs today that they should be ready to send home all non-essential employees scheduled to work tomorrow. President Bush has said he won't sign another temporary funding measure to keep the government operating past midnight tonight, unless the Congress approves an acceptable budget package. Democratic leaders plan to push a funding extension through both houses anyway, in an effort to keep the government running through next Friday. The German parliament today approved the so-called 2+4 unification treaty, which was negotiated with the Allied powers to regulate Germany's security affairs. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Negotiations on the treaty began last spring between the U.S., France, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and the two Germanies. But the final treaty draft only became possible when the Soviet Union agreed this summer to let a united Germany join NATO. In return, the two Germanies pledged to reduce their combined military forces, renounce the stationing of nuclear weapons on East German soil, and to help finance the withdrawal of Soviet troops from East German territory by 1994. The parliaments of the four wartime Allied powers must also ratify the treaty before it formally goes into effect. The German parliament today also ratified an election law that makes it easier for the small citizens' parties formed last fall in East Germany and for the Communist Party to enter parliament in general elections on December 2nd. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
In the Central African country of Rwanda, government soldiers battled rebel forces early this morning in the capital city of Kigali. About 1,500 rebels invaded the country Sunday from neighboring Uganda in an effort to overthrow the government. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
Only yesterday, Rwandan officials were telling the press that they'd broken the backbone of the rebel forces, which U.S. State Department sources estimated about 1,500 soldiers. But the statements turned out to be overly optimistic because early today, fierce fighting was reported in downtown Kigali, the nation's capital, near the presidential palace. And press reports suggested that more rebels might be trying to join the invaders from Uganda. The rebels, who come mainly from the minority Tutsi tribe, are trying to overthrow the government, which is controlled by the majority Hutu tribe. French and Belgian officials, who have closer ties to Rwanda than other European nations, are worried that the fighting could erupt into nationwide tribal warfare. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Nairobi.
Prices were broadly lower today on Wall Street, although the market bounced back from a deeper plunge that came early in the session in reaction to the House rejection of the deficit reduction agreement. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to close at 2,510.64. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 154 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If they ever get around to giving out a Medal of Honor for rock and roll, it's a pretty safe bet that Lenny Kaye would be among the first to receive one. That's how rock critic Billy Altman once described critic, musician, and producer Lenny Kaye. As the guitarist for the Patti Smith Group, Kaye played on some of the most influential rock records of the 70s. His credentials as a producer date back to 1971, when he compiled an anthology called Nuggets that documented the garage bands of the late 60s. More recently, he produced Suzanne Vega's first record. Kaye oversaw Elektra Records' retrospective reissue series, and now he's produced a new anthology celebrating Elektra's 40th anniversary. It's an unusual collection in which performers who currently record for Elektra play songs from earlier Elektra records. The result is musicians sometimes paying homage to music that influenced them, other times performing tunes that are way outside of their typical repertoire. The rapper Shinehead does his version of Josh White's novelty folk ballad One Meatball. Experimentalist Wayne Horvitz, Robin Holcomb, and Bill Frisell reinterpret Bob Dylan's Going, Going, Gone. And the heavy metal band Faster Pussycat does Carly Simon's pop hit You're So Vain. Responsible for matching Faster Pussycat, which is a kind of metal band, with Carly Simon's You're So Vain.
We thought that Carly really deserved to be rocked up a little bit. My only suggestion to that when we came up with it was that they might want to do the song in the first person, but they didn't take it seriously.
How did you come up with the concept for this new anniversary record, The Rubaiyat?
Well, I actually can't take credit for the concept that originated with Bob Krasnow, who's Elektra's chairman at this point. He felt that one of the best ways to celebrate a birthday is not nostalgically or completely looking backwards, but seeing the past through the eyes of the present. And so he decided that it would be a nice way to light the candles on the birthday cake by having the current artist of Elektra cover hits of Elektra's past.
Did you match up the bands with the groups or the songs that they covered?
Yeah, it was kind of a cooperative venture between myself, the bands, and the various A&Rs. We would sit around and think up great classic matchmaking. Sometimes the bands themselves had an idea of who they wanted covered. I know, for instance, Billy Bragg, as soon as he heard about the project, requested to do Arthur Lee in Love. And sometimes the bands didn't quite have an idea of the scope of Elektra's 40 years, and so then it would be my job to make up cassettes of various things I thought might appeal to them and send it their way, and then they'd let me know what they thought, and we'd kind of work out something from there.
Is there a match that you made that you're particularly proud of?
I think the Gypsy Kings doing Hotel California is a hoot and a half, and the one that I feel really good about is Kronos Quartet doing Television's Marquee Moon.
The Gypsy Kings one is a favorite of mine. I think they have this real knack for taking really songs, for taking songs I'd never, they have a real knack for taking songs I'd like to never hear again. and just investing this, like, sincerity in it and really making it work.
Well, I think that track especially works because California certainly has some Espanol roots, and I think they really brought out the kind of movement of culture from, Columbus's day, around Baja California.
Now, the Gypsy Kings are actually a gypsy guitar band. I don't think they speak English, and if they do, it's not very well. Did they have to learn the English lyrics?
Actually, they only do Welcome to the Hotel California. Such
right,
a lovely place.
The accents are all on the wrong syllables.
I mean, but they made me, they actually had one where they even used less English. They had Bienvenido a Hotel California. But they wanted to kind of get across as much as possible. I actually am curious what their lyrics translate, because, things get lost in the translation or gained, as it were. So I wonder what they're actually saying.
Por el camino del desierto, el viento me despeina, sueva aroma de colita, nomada una del aire, ella de lo lejos, una luz en tela, la idea de mezcal, te vi por en la noche, ella estaba a la entrada y la campana de sonar, y me dijo ya a mí mismo, esto puedo del cielo, ella se me una vela. Nuestra del camino, soy voz el corredor y yo te dije diciendo, Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place. Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place,
such a lovely place,
such a lovely place.
such a lovely place.
You have a long history with Elektra Records. What did the label mean to you when you were coming of age?
It really helped me understand the possibilities within rock music when I was kind of getting my feet wet as a young animal in New Jersey. It helped show me that you could have the depth and integrity of art within the exquisite trash of rock and roll. And groups like The Doors, the MC5, the Stooges were really central to the kinds of music that I would attempt to make when I attempted to make it.
Guitarist and record producer and songwriter Lenny Kaye is my guest. And his latest project is an anniversary, 40th anniversary album for Elektra Records. One of the projects that you did for Elektra, and this dates back to 1971, was Nuggets. And this anthology was subtitled Original Artifacts from the First Psychedelic Era, 1965 to 68. This was a collection of singles by groups who basically were known for one hit. What was your concept, the original concept?
The original concept, as given to me by Jack Holzman at the time, was I think he had just gotten one of the first cassette players, and he wanted to cut his record collection down, so his thought was to do an album composed of those cuts from albums that only had one good cut, so he could put them all on one album. And so he gave me the project, and I was kind of a self-styled rock revolutionary at the time, not listening to anybody and trying to make things as lunatic as possible. So I just kind of wrote down a list of 40 or 50 of my favorite songs at the time I was working at Village Oldies in New York. But they seemed to be all kind of local bands, something I've always appreciated and think is really the heartbeat of rock and roll. And kind of music that was not quite psychedelic. That's why I call it the first psychedelic era. It wasn't quite the progressive rock of the Grateful Dead or Quicksilver Messenger Service, but it was certainly not your three-minute pop melodies. And he just let me run with it. I'm forever grateful, and I'm also kind of amazed that the record has lived as long as it did, because it was just kind of an oldies album.
Do you have a favorite on here? I want to play something from the record.
I think Pushing Too Hard really captures the spirit that would, a few years later, turn into punk rock.
The attitude toward these records when you put it out? I think it was a period when a lot of pop was really being looked down on because there weren't, you know, long and often pretentious guitar solos going on. It didn't have the kind of artistic pretensions that rock had taken on by 1971 when you were producing Nuggets.
Well, I think, you know, it helped to write the balance. I'm a big fan of balance in music. I don't like when things are completely one way or the other. I think when that happens, you have to show another side, because human beings are very complex individuals and have many different ways of listening to music. I think if music was all frivolous and fun at the time, maybe I would have put out a record that emphasized symphonic arrangements and, many musics clustered in one, art rock and all of the above. And I think in the early 70s, certainly a balance needed to be adjusted in terms of providing an alternative to a rock and roll that was not only very professional in many of its ways, but also very sterile and somewhat pompous. And I think Nuggets tried to kind of show that one of the reasons that rock and roll came was this outburst of energy that seemed almost anarchic in its conception.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Lenny Kaye. He's a producer, guitarist, songwriter, and all-around rock and roller. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Come
Lenny Kaye's my guest, and he's a guitarist who is a member of the Patti Smith Group. He's recorded albums with his own band. He produced Suzanne Vega's first two albums, more recently worked with Soul Asylum and Michelle Malone. Kaye was the executive producer for the Elektra Records 40th anniversary compilation, Rubaiyat, which has just come out. You used to work in a record store in the Village, in New York's Greenwich Village, called Village Oldies.
Mm-hmm.
talk to me a little bit about record store culture. You know, I've had a lot of friends over the years who work in record stores, and half the people, or more than half the people in record stores, are musicians or obsessive compulsive listeners to music, and a lot of the clientele is like that, too, and it could be a pretty interesting place. It could also be a pretty depressing place.
It is interesting you bring this up, because I found when I worked at Village Oldies, and I am a record collector, and I realize sometimes that what you're essentially doing through your record collection is creating a social life for yourself that, A, you can control, and B, you know, records can be your best friends. At Village Oldies, we would see a lot of people come in whose lives essentially centered around rock and roll, and who receive their sustenance from collecting records and filing them, and, you know, I found it very touching in some ways, it struck me that that's one of the sweet things about record collecting, is that it is a world, and if you enter it, you know, you can be accepted for what you like to listen to, as opposed to, you know, who you are.
You actually met Patti Smith at the record store, didn't you?
Yeah, she would come in. I'd be working on Saturday nights, and we came from somewhat the same area. She was from South Jersey, and I was from Central Jersey, and I spent a lot of summers outside Philly, and we both liked to listen to Jerry Blavitt, the Geeter with the Heater, the Boss with the Hot Sauce, broadcasting all you yon teenagers. We had a lot of records in common, and so she would come in on Saturday nights, and I'd put them on. We'd do the Bristol Stomp, and, you know, we'd hang out, and we were just kind of pals. From that, you know, one night she asked me if I would come play guitar behind one of her poetry readings. She knew I was playing guitar. And I said, sure, and I went and did some abstract expressionism behind some of her poems. And from that little acorn, certainly a big oak tree grew.
Could you play guitar well at that time?
I was actually a little better bass player. I had a good sense of rhythm. I don't think I'd ever played a lead solo ever. It was kind of primitive, but in a sense that worked in my favor, because I had no preconceptions to apply to how to play behind her. What we did was kind of rhythmic and sound effecty, and out of that grew songs and certainly a different way of playing music than if I'd had like a lot of blues licks and immediately, you know, whacked them behind her.
How did the poetry readings develop into you all becoming a rock band?
I think Patti was such a rhythmic reader and very accessible as a poet. And when I first started playing chords behind her, I almost found it easy to pick out, because she would almost sing her poems. She would chant them. And in that kind of way, you know, the music had a chance to kind of grow organically. What we would do was she would do a poem and we kind of get some kind of rhythmic chordal figure and we just jam on it, and she would go into these flights, stream of consciousness, and, you know, pretty soon over the course of a month or 2 months or 3 months of playing it, there'd be certain moves that we would continue to refer to, little accents, little parts that seemed to develop on their way to being choruses or verses. Especially a lot of the early songs on Horses really grew out of no arrangement or no sense of song structure at all. They were just kind of mood pieces that very, you know, found themselves very naturally. We hardly had to write them. We just had to keep playing them until the songs themselves revealed them to us.
What's an example of a song that started out like that?
Free Money certainly started out as just, you know, a repetitious chord pattern. Gloria was another like little riff piece that all of a sudden, you know, we woke up one day and found that it has parts. It has, you know, beginning and an end and a middle and lots of space to fool around in.
Let's listen to Free Money. And this is from the first Patti Smith album, Horses.
Every night before I could sleep, find a ticket win a lottery. Scoop the pearls up from the sea. Cash them in and buy you all the things you need. Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills go swirling at my bed. On a high plane to a jet stream and take you to the stratosphere and check out the planet and then take you down deep where it's hot, hot in the radio, baby, then cool, cold, you feel the snow and we'll roll, drain, roll, drain, roll, roll, drain, drain. When we're dreaming, when we're dreaming.
Patti Smith with my guest Lenny Kaye on guitar. Lenny Kaye is also a record producer, and his latest project is The Rubaiyat, which is a double CD, 40th anniversary of Elektra album. Elektra is a record company, and this is the current artist on the roster doing the songs of the former artists on the Elektra roster. On the liner notes that you wrote for the Nuggets anthology, mm-hmm. you wrote that these bands exemplified the berserk pleasure that comes with being on stage outrageous. What gave you those kinds of berserk pleasures when you were performing with Patti Smith?
Well, my most berserk pleasure came at the climax of Ain't It Strange when Patti and I would do our little dance. Sometimes she would be the masculine entity and she would skewer me, and sometimes vice versa, accompanied by massive howls of feedback.
Was it terrifying for you when Patti Smith fell off stage and broke her neck? It's the kind of thing that you almost don't think is possible, yet it's happened to people. Do you know what I mean? It seems so improbable.
Well, in the context of the night that it happened, it wasn't improbable. I truly believe that it was the music that pushed her off stage. It happened at that moment in Ain't It Strange when we were, we kind of rose it to a peak of frenzy. And at that time, on a really good night, we would like wobble the music. We would like start, it would kind of raise to its peak. And then we would start, making it jerk around and get itself dizzy. And that night we were opening for Bob Seger. It was one of the few times we ever opened for somebody. So we had a space on stage about the size of a large plank, and but we really wanted to get this audience of people who really had no idea who we were. We were really working it. We were really there. And I remember at the height of this thing, we got the music and Patti started spinning. We started spinning her with the music. We were really locked, and she just spun right off stage. Hand of God, feel the finger. And I feel that moment was the real turning point of the Patti Smith Group, where our music moved from one of intense confrontation to almost conciliation, that to me is the story of the Patti Smith Group. You begin Horses with Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine, and you end with Wave with a very sweet tone poem to, a martyred pope. And, that moment in Ain't It Strange on a stage in Tampa, Florida, was when we it's like the expanding and contracting universe. We expanded out to that moment, and from there on it was kind of a reconciliation.
When she gave up music, were you ready to leave the band too?
Oh, yeah. The band was done. We had no songs left. We had done everything we set out to do except for maybe make money, but, that's part of being a rock musician. You have to have certain stories about, starving forever. But, the band had really done what it set out to do. The only thing left would have to be a pop band, being a jukebox of your hits, and that was never really the reason why we formed. I think all of us felt like the Patti Smith Group was our 70s movie that began in front of 200 people at St. Mark's Church in the Lower East Side of New York and ended before 70,000 people in Florence, Italy. And, you know, where else could you go but that? We don't want to see a Jaws 2 or anything. I really do. I have no real sense of loss about the band. I really am happy that we went out with our flags flying.
Are you playing guitar much now?
I've recently, ever since this Electra project finished up, I've been, you know, getting the guitar on and playing in various New Jersey bars under a variety of pseudonyms. I have no sense of direction about this. I don't want a record deal. The music I play has no real category. I play sometimes with these jazz musicians, though the music we play isn't really jazz. It's just, you know, whatever comes out. I'm mostly doing it for the sheer pleasure of it, but also to remember why I did it in the first place and to not get caught up in having to direct it into anything or any, you know, record or, you know, actual artistic concept. I just want to connect with the original sin.
Why do you need a pseudonym to play?
Well, it's not that I'm so extremely famous, but I find that I tend to have no self-consciousness. I mean, it's not really a pseudonym. I just don't tell anybody that I'm in the band. It's like, you know, playing with sunglasses on and stuff. I really, the communion that I'm looking for is really between me and my guitar and to present it to people without any sense of context. I don't want them to say, well, this is what Lenny Kaye is doing now or who is that guitar player. I just want them to listen to the tone and what I'm playing and see if I can get them like that. Again, I'm trying to do it with as little sense of ego as possible and to remember what the music's about. I think sometimes, especially in these media-driven times, people are very concerned with who's who and who's doing what and are very quick to judge movement. I know one of the lucky things about the Patti Smith Group is that we had a long period of time in which to find ourselves because we had no sense of direction. And essentially what I'm doing now is kind of loosing myself from any of the perimeter or the paraphernalia that the music business, you know, gives you and just getting back to music itself and seeing what it is I have to say and why I want to say it and, you know, kind of getting an internal loop within myself.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Lenny Kaye is the executive producer of Elektra Records' 40th anniversary compilation, Rubaiyat, which features current Elektra artists doing new interpretations of songs of Elektra artists from the past 40 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's another song from the Rubaiyat. This is reggae rapper Shinehead doing the song One Meatball, which was originally recorded by Josh White in 1956.
Man, it wasn't long ago back in the days, man. Them was some rough times, you know what I'm saying? Wasn't no food, no money, no jobs, no clothes.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Michael Rooker played a jealous killer in Sea of Love, a corrupt baseball player in Eight Men Out, and a sociopath in Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Coming up, a talk about sensitivity with Michael Rooker. Also, actor and writer John O'Keefe takes us inside the video game Inside His Mind. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Henry and June, based on the relationship between writers Henry Miller and Anais Nin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a temporary funding measure to keep the government operating until next Friday by a vote of 300 to 113. The White House has said the president will not sign another temporary funding document to keep the government operating past midnight tonight unless Congress approves an acceptable budget package. In the meantime, the Bush administration has started making plans for a government-wide shutdown. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Budget Director Richard Darman sent a memo to heads of federal agencies today saying that beginning tomorrow morning, their departments must be prepared to implement their existing plans for closing down operations. The only exemptions will be those activities authorized by law or that protect life and property. Among the exemptions are the nation's 17,000 air traffic controllers. An FAA spokesman said they will work throughout the long holiday weekend at normal staffing levels. Since tomorrow is the start of a three-day weekend, the full impact of a government-wide shutdown wouldn't be felt until Tuesday. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
In Cincinnati, a jury there has acquitted an art gallery and its director on charges of obscenity in connection with photographs by the late Robert Mapplethorpe. The jury of four men and four women returned verdicts of not guilty for the Contemporary Arts Center and its director after deliberating for 3.5 hours. Countdown continues for the liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery tomorrow morning. As Dave Pignanelli reports, a legal challenge to launch has been denied.
A Washington federal judge has given NASA the go-ahead today to proceed with the launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery. Anti-nuclear activists sought to delay the launch because of the radioactive plutonium on board the shuttle. The Space Shuttle Discovery is the last space plane to fly for NASA as repairs continue on the shuttles Columbia and Atlantis. Both suffer from unexplained fuel leaks. Discovery has never had a fuel leak, and NASA doubts that one will crop up in time to stop the launch. Fueling begins tonight at 11:15 Eastern Time. Discovery is scheduled to carry the solar probe Ulysses into space. The $250 million European spacecraft will spend 5 years traveling to the sun to study the giant star's poles. If all goes as planned, liftoff will occur at 7:35 Eastern Time tomorrow morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Diplomats from North and South Korea have clashed over membership in the United Nations, with Seoul demanding two separate memberships and the North calling for a single shared seat. Talks were held for 2.5 hours in an effort to settle differences over the UN membership issue. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 6 points to close at 2,510.64 on volume of 154 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Performer and writer John O'Keefe first visited our show 1.5 years ago to do an excerpt from his solo work, Shimmer. It was about his troubled adolescence growing up in Iowa. John O'Keefe is back with something from his new work, Vid.
Vid is a two-story piece. The first story is an autobiographical story about me coming fresh from the University of Iowa and my MFA to Berkeley, California in 1973, when it was really quite a crazy town, and how my life gradually deteriorates from that point on until I'm living in my camper in a parking lot. The second story is about a fictitious video game, an adventure video game that I invent. The main character is this little elf guy called Gig, who's chasing after an evil entity called Bog Pie. And the pieces that I'm going to read for you, the first one is from the autobiographical section, and the second one is from the fictitious video game section. The first video game I ever saw was Pong. It was around 1974 in the basement of a frat bar in Berkeley, California on Telegraph Avenue. I was living in my VW camper at that time, and a few of my friends who were living in houses had decided I needed a good meal and a change of scenery. We were sitting at a table, and gathered near us were a group of pitcher-drinking 20-year-olds. Two of them were hovering over an upright cabinet, their faces lit by an eerie, almost numinous glow, as if they were gazing at some kind of synthetic nativity scene. There was something about the energy coming from around that box that drew me to it. I could hear the sound of electronic noise, one of the first things you're going to have to like if you're going to engage in video mania. Come on, sucker! There was a languid beep, then bonk, beep, then bonk, beep, bonk, beep, bonk. What a wimp! I got your ass! At first I was distracted by the familiar homophobic ritual of fall rush. Are you cross-eyed or something? Ha ha, got you again, maggot! It was a screen they were hunkered over, black with white stripes, delineating what was obviously a ping-pong table. But it was electric. No messy balls to chase, no old paddles with worn rubber facing, just two white rectangles. I wondered as I strolled back to my friends if I could play the game against the computer. It cost a quarter, and in my present financial condition, a quarter went a long way towards eggs and hash browns or a bottle of Rossi Varietal. When I stumbled back to my camper that night, my usual haze of depression was broken by thoughts of new possibilities. Perhaps the dim-witted convulsions of the human world could, with the sheer weight of time, fumble to form a new universe. Perhaps we bad monkeys were just the crippled midwives for a new creation. Yes, perhaps in this simple game of Pong, there was hope. Ska! I'm in sheer space, rushing again toward the honeycomb, watching the souls find their places in the cells. I grab the large lifesaver. It looks like a steering wheel. I hold it in front of me. The hole in the middle of it begins to whistle in the updraft. The whistle becomes a shriek. Light twists through the hole in a thin ray. Phew! The toxic honey melts. Yes, yes, I cry, as the viscid layer melts away, exposing a black cell. My passageway. Come on in, croons the voice from the hole. Come on in and catch me. I stand before a cereal box landscape, rolling hills with a lollipop sun. The air is sweet with a slight tinge of strawberry Kool-Aid. The trees are asparagus green. The meadows of corncob yellow hay roll down to chocolate-colored fire trails. The sky is isotope blue. I remember my sword made from the rudder of an old ship and a scabbard with a map now deeply etched in its side. Checking the map, I see a little elf representing me in my position. This is the map of my journey, I utter, my voice strangely high in the helium air. A sparrow flies across the sky, stops, stuck there, as if someone had cut the frame loose from the film and left the world in frozen photography. Can I move? Yes. I hear a voice within me whisper, if you make the world move with you. And I do. I don't move my foot over the path. I move the path under my foot. The bird on sticks and flies east. There's a tinkling. A cloud of birds is rushing towards me. Suddenly my face is covered with hundreds of chickadees. They scatter and they land in a tree. My face is moist. I draw my fingers back. There's blood on my fingers. They've made hundreds of perforations in my face and scalp. Again, I hear this eerie tinkle. From the sun, a cloud appears with a high, lisping calls of cedar wax wings. Suddenly, they're on my body, their shining eyes a blur, their lovely crests moving like tiny, delicate hammers. Once again, like the chickadees, they're gone, filling a red tree like brown nuts. My body's damp. It's blood. But like my face, it quickly dries. I brush the blood away. My arms and fingers are a swirl with vines and alien insignia. I figure my face is covered with them, too. Tattoos. In the tree, one by one, chickadee and waxwing fall, dropping like apples I hurry the path along, the lollipop sun melting like a hot orange oyster. As I walk, the sky grows dimmer. So that's the way it works. The faster I walk, the darker the sky. I walk faster, and darkness surrounds me.
John O'Keefe performing an excerpt of Vid. He performs at the Painted Bride Art Center in Philadelphia this weekend, NPS 122 in New York in November. This is Fresh Air. Michael Rooker was the star of one of this year's most disturbing movies. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is an independently made, low-budget drama about a sociopath. It just came out on home video. Rooker has played other sinister movie characters. In Eight Men Out, he was a corrupt baseball player. In Mississippi Burning, he was a vicious Klansman. And in Sea of Love, he was a dangerous repairman. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, was made 5 years ago, but wasn't released until earlier this year. I asked Michael Rooker if he ever thought the movie would come back to haunt him.
Oh, yeah. A lot of times. You never know, you know. I mean, you do things, and it's early on in your career, and it was just the wrong time 5 years ago, and it came back, and people were ready for it. Some people were, anyway.
When you thought that the movie might come back and haunt you, what were the types of things you'd worry about?
Well, casting, mainly.
Yeah.
Future work.
You would have been better known, but you would have been typecast.
Well, I don't know if I would have been better known, but I would have been definitely typecast more than I was. And as it is, I mean, Sea of Love, Mississippi Burning, those aren't quite the kind of
nice guy roles
you'd want to marry, you know?
Let me ask you some more things about Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. When I interviewed the director of Henry, I told him that I really liked the way you'd played Henry because here you were playing a sociopath with no capacity for feelings, but you played it in this low-key, introverted way that made it easy for, like, the girlfriend character in the movie to interpret you as being, having wounded sensitivity.
As long as I can remember, she'd be bringing men up to the house. My daddy was there, too, but it didn't matter nothing to her. She'd make me watch it.
That's creepy.
She beat me, too, a lot. She beat me when I wouldn't watch it. And sometimes she beat me and make me wear a dress and watch her doing it. Then they'd laugh at me.
She made you wear a dress?
You think I'm lying?
I know you. Like I've known you for a long time. I feel like I've known you forever and ever.
The director said that that was your idea, that that was all your interpretation. So I'm interested in the insights you had into this character that led you to play it in this kind of way where this sociopath lacking emotions could be interpreted as being really sensitive.
He wasn't a big talker, you know. He had a lot of problems. It was almost as if it was anti-acting. It was completely opposite of what I had done in school. And so it was a major problem for me to sort of figure out a way to do this guy that would not be some crazy loony, you know. And I'd seen some interviews with the real person. And it reminded me of my dad, really, who was a very soft-spoken man, very gentle and not very aggressive person. But when the kids were doing something wrong or something, his voice would, you know, get very firm and very stern at times. It just gave me a feeling of, I mean, that's the only way it could have been done. I felt the guy had been lobotomized, basically, emotionally. Totally lobotomized, and there was not much there.
Every role I've seen you in, I think, you've played someone from a working-class background. And I was wondering what kind of background you're from.
Well, I'm working class, but below working class, you know. Whatever. I grew up in Alabama until I was 13, and it was what they call down there is being on the wrong side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all the poor people, basically. You know, all the people living on welfare and getting government subsidies or whatever, you know. Yeah, the people who can't, who don't, a lot of times don't even have jobs, but try to make do the best way they know how. And my dad and the people that I grew up with were like miners and truck drivers and stuff like that. And by the time I moved to Chicago, it was just me and my my mom and my five sisters. So we grew up on the Nelson Algren's neighborhood, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Milwaukee Division, Ashland. And went to school at Wells High School, where it was very popular to drop bowling balls from the third floor. Back, I don't know if they're still doing it, but back then it was kind of rough school. And I sort of hid in the corner until I could get into the class or something.
Well, were you picked on at all for being the Southerner moved north?
Oh, when I first got here, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was a major culture shock.
Yeah, what did you have to adjust to?
Well, basically, I had this accent that you couldn't even understand. And my hair was always cut short. And I was a real skinny kid. So I just looked very funny. And people just felt like, hey, come over here. I want to punch you in the nose. And I wouldn't allow them to do that. But I blend in. I try to blend in as quickly as possible. I mean, it was rough there for a while.
Did you know how to fight?
Well, yeah. I learned very quickly. Yeah.
Did you have racial adjustments you had to make moving from the South to the North?
As a matter of fact, I did. I mean, all I knew was where I was. I mean, there were no black people or Spanish people or any other kind of races involved in my hometown. It was just very white, very very poor, you know, just kind of small town thing. And the black people lived over in a whole different part of town, which was basically their own town. You know, they had their own swimming pools, their own schools. And so I never had any kind of social involvement with black people until I moved to Chicago.
And what was that like? I mean, were you distrusting initially?
I guess I must have come at a very, very pivotal time. I got here and we moved, and basically it was almost an all-black neighborhood. So it was like, it was meant to be, you know. So I got there, and the school was, I think it was called, I forget the name of the school. But it was mostly black, and the reason we moved there was because basically we couldn't afford anywhere else, you know. And eventually that stuck in my mind. These black people are just like me. We can't afford anything. They can't afford anything. They bleed. I bleed. When I punch them, they punch me. I bleed too. We're the same. And I had lots of fights there. Primarily because of who I was and the attitude I had, you know.
What attitude?
Well, I mean, I didn't know any black people.
Yeah.
And just never socialized with them. And it was a problem when I first arrived.
For some people, for some men, acting would seem to go against the kind of macho image that they wanted to have. I think this is especially true a few years ago when you would have been coming of age. I wonder if you ever had reservations like that when you were young and thinking that acting might be interesting.
Well, I thought acting would be interesting, but I did. It was not the thing to do. It was not work, basically. It was not work. You know, coming from the background I came from, people, you know, miners and truck drivers and people who really get their hands dirty and work hard, like 14, 15-hour days, you know, come home dirty and smelly and sweaty and everything. This acting had nothing to do with that. And so, I steered away from it for a long time. I didn't really I found what I really love to do and what I, my dream, you know, what I desired to do all my life and never really had the guts or the ego to really pursue. And that started occurring probably in my early 20s.
As someone who's starring in one movie that has some really interesting, very disturbing scenes in it, I'm wondering if when you were young, if there were any movies you saw that were very disturbing and you loved, that really stuck with you.
No, there were almost no movies I saw when I was young that I loved. I didn't see any very good movies at all until I was in my late teens when I started meeting and hanging out with theater people in junior college there. Most of the time when we went to the movie house, the folks would take the kids and drop us off. And it didn't matter what was playing. They just drop us off and we'd go in. And it was usually Abbott and Lou Costello meets Frankenstein or something like that, you know, or a Godzilla movie or, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what I grew up on, Three Stooges stuff. And, you know, they were good. I mean, it was fun. I like that. I like that kind of comedy, very physical comedy and stuff. But I never saw myself doing that as, you know, as an actor or anything like that. And it never even occurred to me to do that kind of thing.
Well, Michael Rooker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Rooker stars in the film Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which has just come out on home video. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today, news from Washington, D.C. of efforts on Capitol Hill and in the administration to figure out what to do next now that the House of Representatives has voted against the compromise budget deficit agreement worked out by the president and leaders of both parties in both houses of Congress. Also, we have a story today about a new development at Harlem Hospital in New York City, a pediatric trauma unit. One sign of the times there, so many kids being injured by a gunfire in the inner city and also traumatized psychologically by the things they see and experience.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week, the Motion Picture Association of America established the new rating NC-17 as an alternative to the controversial X. The first film to receive the new rating is Henry and June. In Dedham, Massachusetts, town officials are threatening to close a movie theater if it shows Henry and June. The movie is based on the uncensored version of Anais Nin's diaries, which were first published in 1986. Owen Gleiberman has a review.
There's no doubt in my mind that Philip Kaufman has become one of the great American directors. His last film, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, was a triumph, one of the sexiest and most haunting movies ever made about the differences between lust and love. The movie worked because it had plenty of both. In Henry and June, Kaufman is trying to deepen the erotic explorations of unbearable lightness. But this new movie feels arty and distant. Kaufman's gotten hold of a great subject. Henry and June is set in Paris in the early 30s, and tells the story of three famously obsessive romantics. At the center is Henry Miller, the great visionary lowlife of American fiction. There's also his wife June, a Brooklyn dance hall girl who became his muse and scapegoat. And there's Anais Nin, the proto-feminist bourgeois who thirsted for sensuality, liberation, and danger. In the movie, Anais falls for both Henry and June. With Henry, her fellow writer, it's a meeting of minds and bodies. She becomes his student in passion. But it's June whom Anais is truly in love with. After many fits and starts, Henry and June becomes a feminist awakening movie, the story of a lesbian attraction that, for Nin, is really a dawning of the self. At the same time, she's still devoted to Miller, who we see completing his exhilaratingly scuzzy masterpiece, Tropic of Cancer.
It's finished now.
Not yet. Now we've got to get it published.
Published? Who'll publish it? I know what they'll say. There's even laws against what I've written. But I feel good now. I'm ready to celebrate my failure.
I won't let you be a failure. I'll make the world listen to you, I promise. I'm ready now to call on the Pope, on all the kings, and on all the editors and the publishers in the world to get them to support you.
The biggest disappointment of Henry and June is that after all the controversy surrounding its original X rating, the movie isn't very erotic. It certainly has plenty of sex scenes, but most of them are so relentlessly fraught with meaning that the film ends up treating eroticism as a form of higher education. Watching Henry and June, you could easily forget that one of the main reasons people fall into bed with each other is to enjoy themselves. The actors are lively and talented, but the characters they're playing never seem quite organic. Fred Ward overdoes Miller's Brooklyn growl and plays him as a kind of smiling, macho Mr. Life Force. What Ward doesn't suggest, except in one or two scenes, is Miller's despair, his intellectual sensitivity. As Anais, Maria de Medeiros certainly looks the part, and she's appealingly impish. Yet her spiritual questings have little weight on screen. As a writer, Nin had a tense, exploratory mind that's scarcely in evidence here. Surprisingly, the most convincing moments belong to Uma Thurman's June. In a way, the spectacularly gorgeous Thurman has no place in this movie. Henry Miller's entire liberating notion of sexuality centered on women who don't look like Uma Thurman. But she gives June a touching awkwardness, especially in the scenes where she yearns to be idealized in her husband's writing. The other characters talk about passion. Thurman's June is the one who catches fire.
Owen Globerman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our reviews and readings are produced by Naomi Person. Phyllis Myers and Amy Salad produce Fresh Air's interviews with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, SCTV alum Dave Thomas tells us about going solo. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers some forgotten verses of popular songs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.